Welcome to the Deep Dive, the place where we take the essential sources, articles, and research on a subject and distill them into the core knowledge you need to be truly informed.
And today, we are attempting something truly challenging.
I'll say. We're charting the 7-decade shape-shifting career of a true artistic monolith, Dame Judi Dench.
It is a monumental task, and you're right, monumental is the word, because her career isn't just long. I mean, it's deep, it's wide, and it's full of these wonderful contradictions.
So what's our mission here? What are we trying to get at?
Well, our mission today is to go far beyond just listing achievements. We want to understand the mechanisms of her success.
How she pulled it all off.
Exactly. How did she achieve this massive, consistent success across classical theater, a beloved television, and then pivot to late career global film superstardom.
And often at the same time.
At the same time. And crucially, how does she maintain that relentless output and that integrity while facing some really significant personal losses and profound health challenges?
Okay, let's unpack this immediately, because the sources we've looked at paint a picture not just of a great actress, but of a specific kind of resilience.
Yes.
You just can't talk about Judi Dench without talking about the sheer weight of her achievement.
No, you can't. I mean, we're talking about a person widely considered one of Britain's greatest actresses.
And ever. But let's look at the ledger.
Let's do it. You've got an Academy Award, a Tony Award, 2 Golden Globes, 4 British Academy Television Awards.
6 British Academy Film Awards.
And 7 Olivier Awards for performance. 7. That's a world record for competitive performance, Olivier's.
Yeah, it's just astounding.
But here's the thing that really underlines her early dominance. She completed the British Triple Crown. That means winning competitive awards from BAFTA, the Olivier's, and the Evening Standard Awards remarkably early.
How early are we talking?
Between 1966 and 1977. So this wasn't an actor just hoping for a break. She was already a colossus of the British stage and small screen decades before Hollywood even, thought to cast her.
Yeah. That distinction is so key. She didn't need Hollywood to validate her.
No.
Hollywood needed her gravitas to validate their projects.
That's it, exactly. And if we need a single immediate hook nugget to prove this theme of disproportionate, unforgettable impact.
I think I know where you're going.
It has to be the 1998 Oscar win.
For Shakespeare in Love, she won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress playing Queen Elizabeth I.
After appearing on screen for a grand total of 8 minutes.
8 minutes. It's the definitive Dench story, isn't it?
It really is. And as we explore the rest of her career, you should keep that in mind. She has this almost unique ability to walk onto a set, own the entire space, and just imprint her performance on your memory, no matter how short the scene is.
It's like every moment is just optimized for impact.
Perfectly put. It tells you everything you need to know about her craft.
To really understand the power of that 8-minute performance in 1998, we absolutely have to go back to the beginning.
Way back.
Because she was steeped in the theater world from birth, though not necessarily as, an aspiring starlet.
That's right. Judi Dench, born Judith Olivia Dench, on December 9th, 1934, in Heesworth, York, she came from a background of stability and professional service.
Not a typical artsy family, then.
Not at all, and I think the grounding really helped her long career. Her father, Reginald Arthur Dench, was an English doctor and a decorated WWI veteran. Her mother, Eleanor Olave, was Irish. They met at Trinity College, Dublin.
So you have this blend of solid professionalism, the doctor, the veteran, and this immediate hands-on connection to the arts.
Precisely, because her father served as the GP for the York Theatre Royal.
The local doctor for the theater.
And her mother was, perhaps even more relevantly, the theater's wardrobe mistress.
Wow. So just imagine growing up in that house.
Right. The theater wasn't this glamorous, distant place. It was her parents' workplace. The actors were literally house guests.
They were always staying at the Dench household.
So she saw the reality of it, the effort, the process, the chaos. She even got her first taste of performance playing the Virgin Mary in the amateur York mystery plays in 1957. Speaks to that deep community connection.
Now for a purely fun, deep dive historical nugget that makes her seem even more, impossibly storied.
Oh, I love this one.
The sources reveal some pretty surprising ancestry that was uncovered on the BBC program Who Do You Think You Are in 2021?
Yes. This is where it gets really dramatic. It turns out she's descended from the Bill family of Danish aristocrats.
Okay.
And this family includes a man named Claus Bill. Now, why is that relevant? Because Claus Bill was the grandfather of the famous 16th century astronomer Tycho Brahe.
Get out of here, Tycho Brahe.
The very same. It's a completely irrelevant, but just wonderfully dramatic historical footnote that links her not just to the stage, but to nobility and, you know, the study of the stars centuries ago.
It definitely adds to the mythology. But maybe the biggest real-world influence on her core values was her education and her faith.
Absolutely central. She attended the Mount School, which is a Quaker independent secondary school in York, and she became a Quaker herself.
And she's been quoted on this, hasn't she?
Yes, in a 2013 interview, she said, "The faith informs everything I do."
And that Quaker influence, it seems so central to understanding her public persona.
I think so. Quakerism emphasizes simplicity, truth, community service, that quiet moral center, that insistence on integrity over flash.
That seems to be what allows her to take on these vastly different roles, a queen, a villain.
And imbue them all with a level of seriousness and honesty.
But I wonder, how does someone steeped in that quiet integrity suddenly decide to embrace the life of an actress, which is, you know, often inherently loud and attention-seeking?
Well, what's so fascinating is that she didn't, not at first.
What do you mean?
She initially trained as a set designer. She was interested in the craft of the theater, the creation of the world, not necessarily standing in the middle of it.
So she understood the whole production.
Which I think informs her respect for every technical aspect of acting.
So the pivot, what was the moment?
The pivot was intensely personal and based on pure inspiration. She said that seeing Peggy Ashcroft play Cleopatra on stage changed my life.
Wow.
It was a moment of recognition, you know, realizing the transformative power of performance, and it just channeled her focus entirely. She applied to the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama in London.
And she didn't just attend, did she? She dominated.
She did. She graduated with immediate acclaim. She was a classmate of Vanessa Redgrave, and she won 4 acting prizes, including the gold medal as outstanding student.
So right out of the gate, she was recognized as exceptional.
Which meant her professional journey began with the best pedigree possible. She made her debut in September 1957 as Ophelia in Hamlet with the Old Vic Company. And the Old Vic at that time was the launching pad for classical actors in Britain.
She spent 4 formative seasons there just building this incredible classical resume.
Key early Shakespearean roles included Catherine in Henry V in 1958. That was her New York City debut. And Juliet in Romeo and Juliet in 1960.
And that was directed by Franco Zeffirelli, right? Who later became a giant of film and opera direction.
The very same. She was setting a trajectory toward the highest echelons of classical performance from day one.
But the truly impressive part of this early phase is how quickly she branched out.
Oh, yeah. By the mid-60s, she was already balancing stage work with significant screen roles. This is critical because most of her generation stayed strictly theatrical for much, much longer.
She won the 1966 BAFTA Award for Most Promising Newcomer for 4 in the Morning, and then that same year.
The very same year, she clinched the BAFTA for Best Actress for her performance in the intense 4-part TV series, Talking to a Stranger.
So this immediate mastery of the British film and TV landscape, in parallel with her stage work, that's what started defining her versatility so early on.
It's proof that she possessed that rare quality. The ability to scale her performance up for the stage and then scale it right down for the camera, all while maintaining authenticity. By her early 30s, she was already operating at a level that garnered the highest domestic awards across all 3 mediums.
Now, here's where it gets really interesting. In the 1960s, the move to musical theater.
Yeah.
In 1968, she takes on the role of Sally Bowles in the musical Cabaret. That seems like a complete artistic detour from Ophelia and Juliet.
It absolutely was. And according to the sources, it was a terrifying experience for her. She was deeply reluctant to sing in public.
I've heard the story about the audition.
It's wonderful, isn't it? She was so frightened that she performed the songs from the wings, leaving the pianists alone on stage. She was essentially hiding from the casting directors.
Wait, she auditioned while literally hiding from them, and she still got the part.
She did, and she drew excellent reviews for that run at the Palace Theater. One critic specifically praised her singing, noting that the title song is projected with great feeling.
So what does that tell you about her?
It shows this crucial element of her professional makeup, a willingness to accept challenges, even when they trigger profound personal fear if the material demands it. This early period established that the Quaker girl who trained in set design was in fact an absolute theatrical chameleon.
That fear, combined with that praise, just perfectly underscores that this versatility wasn't always comfortable, but it was always critically rewarded.
And that set the stage for the next 2 decades of her dominance in Britain. Moving into the 70s and 80s, the focus shifts overwhelmingly to the stage. specifically her long tenure with the Royal Shakespeare Company, the RSC.
This is where she goes from being a star to becoming a theatrical institution.
Absolutely. She spent nearly two decades as a core member, and that became the main engine for her critical success. It's where she racked up the majority of her Best Actress awards.
She'd already proved her technical skill, but how do you take that raw talent and turn it into the kind of stage authority that defines a generation? That's what the RSC gave her, isn't it? The chance to dig into the most complex roles over and over again.
Precisely. This period wasn't about quick hits. It was about immersive study. She took on roles like The Duchess in John Webster's dark and dense tragedy, The Duchess of Malfi in 1971.
That's grueling stuff. Complex verse drama. Demands immense vocal control, emotional stamina.
And she mastered it. But the landmark achievement of this entire era, the one that critics still talk about with reverence, was her Lady Macbeth.
Right, and Trevor Nunn's acclaimed 1976 production. Why was this Macbeth so defining?
The production itself was revolutionary. It was performed at the Other Place Theater in Stratford, a tiny, intimate space with a minimalist design, small round stage.
So it stripped away all the spectacle?
Completely. It forced the audience to focus intensely on the psychological dynamics, particularly the relationship between Macbeth and his wife.
That sounds like a pressure cooker for an actor.
It was. And Dinch delivered a performance that elevated the role from a mere villainess to a study in inner turmoil and raw ambition.
The reviews were ecstatic, weren't they?
The sources quote them. Michael Billington in The Guardian wrote, "If this is not great acting, I don't know what is." And J.C. Truman, a very respected traditional critic, said he would be astonished if the performance is matched by any in this actress's generation.
And that's the role that won her the Sweat Best Actress Award in 1977.
It is. We should probably pause on that for a second, because the Sweat Award might sound like an unfamiliar acronym to some.
Good point. It's a critical piece of British theatrical history.
It is. The Sweat Awards were established by the Society of West End Theatre, and they were the precursors to what we now know as the Olivier Awards.
Which were named after Laurence Olivier in 1984.
So when she won the Sweat for Lady Macbeth, she was winning the highest theatrical honor available in Britain. It was essentially her first Olivier.
That performance cemented her mastery of tragedy, but what makes her so unique is that she immediately pivoted.
Right back to comedy.
Demonstrating what critics called consummate skill as a comic actress. She partnered with Donald Sinden in a revival of Much Ado About Nothing as Beatrice and Benedick.
And this duality is the core of her theatrical legacy. To move from the harrowing intensity of a murderous Lady Macbeth to the sparkling, quick-witted, romantic sparring of Beatrice, sometimes in the same year, is just an astonishing demonstration of range.
There was one critic who summed it up perfectly.
Bernard Levin of the Sunday Times. He declared her perhaps the very best we have as a comic actress. She could handle the heavy verse and the dark emotion of tragedy, but she could equally deliver flawless comic rhythm and timing.
It's proof that she was never boxed in. Even by her own colossal success, she kept seeking out the opposite extreme. And we also see her start to move into a mentoring role around this time.
That's right. She transitions behind the scenes and makes her debut as a director in 1988 with the Renaissance Theatre Company's touring season.
And the play she chose to direct.
Much Ado About Nothing, of course. Yeah. A piece she clearly adored and understood intimately.
And the cast she directed was foundational for the next generation.
It was Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson.
Wow. Directing your peers and directing stars who are rapidly rising, that's a serious responsibility.
It shows she was not just performing, but actively influencing the future of the classical stage. She was passing on the knowledge she had amassed over two decades at the RSC.
But at the same time, she was making herself a household name in a much more intimate and accessible way.
Through television. This is where she becomes the national treasure figure we know.
Which brings us to A Fine Romance. It aired on ITV from 1981 to 1984. This romantic comedy was incredibly popular, and critically, she starred in it alongside her husband, Michael Williams.
And this was a brilliant move. I mean, perhaps unintentional, but it cemented her public identity as accessible and charming. The real-life partnership gave the on-screen chemistry a tangible intimacy that just resonated deeply with the British public.
The show won a BAFTA award.
It did. And for millions who never set foot in the RSC, this was their Judi Dench, a lovely, slightly exasperated woman navigating life and love.
This television success is such a fascinating counterpoint to her rigorous classical life. She later had similar success with The Antinality. As time goes by starting in 1992, another beloved rom-com.
These long-running TV roles provided the necessary balance. It prevented her from being perceived as purely an austere, distant classical performer. She showed she could embody Lady Macbeth and the relatable frustration of a woman in a sitcom.
During the 80s, her film roles remained supportive but prestigious.
Very much so. She appeared in James Ivory's beautiful period piece, A Room with a View, in 1985. And in the cherished 84 Charing Cross Road in 1987 with Anne Bancroft and Anthony Hopkins.
These weren't blockbuster leading roles.
No, but they were high-quality, respected ensemble pieces. Her selections show a priority for good writing and strong casts, not headline billing. She was clearly driven by the quality of the project.
And we mentioned earlier that she embodies the entire spectrum of British culture, so we cannot skip the niche but utterly beloved fact that she participated in one of the great British institutions.
Ah, yes, the radio soap opera.
The Archers. She was cast as Prue Forrest, the longtime silent wife of Tom Forrest, on its 10,000th edition in 1989.
So she went from Lady Macbeth and directing Kenneth Branagh to playing a woman famous for never speaking. What does that tell us?
It tells us she doesn't take herself too seriously, and she appreciates the cultural importance of these deeply ingrained British traditions. It's a small detail, but it shows her willingness to participate in mainstream culture at every level.
And this immense breadth, this status as a celebrated theatrical colossus who was also a TV darling, is what prepared her for the truly global pivot of the 1990s.
The 1990s. This marked the great external pivot. She transitioned almost overnight from a revered British institution to a global movie star.
And that shift started, perhaps surprisingly, by taking on the role of a bureaucratic spymaster.
We begin with the M era.
Starting in 1995 with GoldenEye, the Bond franchise was rebooting after a long hiatus. They brought in Pierce Brosnan, and the decision to cast Dench as M, James Bond's boss, was, well, it was nothing short of genius.
This wasn't just recasting a character, was it? It was a profound statement about modernizing the franchise. She became the first woman to portray M.
It instantly signaled that the Cold War era of Bond was over. The intelligence world was changing.
And the sources confirmed this was a deliberate choice. The character of M was reportedly modeled on Dame Stella Remington,
who had served as the real-life head of MI5 between 1992 and 1996.
So by casting Dench, they were embedding the character with this genuine gravitas and authority of a serious, high-ranking official who could and would dress down James Bond.
And she does. Her M wasn't just a facilitator. She was an intellectual challenge to Bond's old-school machismo. She famously calls him a misogynistic dinosaur in her very first scene.
Her M had teeth and moral authority drawn directly from Dench's stage presence.
And she's been on to play M in 8 James Bond films, including a really significant plot-driving role in The World Is Not Enough in 1999, where the villain targets M personally. She was deeply integrated into the narrative.
The climax of her role came in Skyfall in 2012, her 7th appearance. That performance was praised by critics as compellingly luminous.
It was the ultimate payoff. It gave her M a full emotional arc and a tragic, dramatic conclusion. Though she did return for a poignant cameo in Spectre in 2015, her presence provided the necessary weight for Daniel Craig's grittier, more grounded Bond. She was his emotional anchor.
So at the same time she's becoming internationally famous as this stern spymaster, Hollywood finally realizes she isn't just a supporting player, she can anchor a serious drama.
And this pivot was incredibly rapid and effective. Her Hollywood breakthrough came as Queen Victoria in Mrs. Brown in 1997.
And that film was originally intended for British television, right?
It was. But its success, upon release earning over $13 million worldwide, catapulted her into the Oscar conversation. It secured her first Academy Award nomination for Best Actress. She was 63 years old.
Imagine that. Achieving your first Oscar nomination as a lead actress in your mid-60s, it's nearly unprecedented. And she had a fantastic, highly quotable anecdote about the film's acquisition.
Yes. While accepting a BFI award in 2011, she joked the film launched her career and that she got a fake tattoo of Harvey Weinstein's name on her backside.
Which was a joke, to be clear.
Yes. A joke about his successful acquisition and distribution of the movie. But that story perfectly illustrates the sudden, powerful acceleration of her visibility in the late 90s. She was finally engaging with the American film industry at its highest level.
And then, just 1 year later, comes the second breakthrough that cemented her global status, Shakespeare in Love.
Back to the 8-minute win.
We have to return to it, but I wonder, was it purely 8 minutes of brilliance, or was that win also a recognition of the 40 years of unrewarded stage work that preceded it?
That is the essential deep dive question. While the performance itself, full of regal authority and wit, was brilliant, it's highly likely the Oscar was partially a cumulative recognition. Hollywood rarely celebrates theater stars adequately until they do something utterly undeniable.
The New York Times called her Elizabeth I, one of the film's utmost treats. She was just dominant in those brief moments.
And she delivered that legendary, perfectly timed acceptance joke, saying on stage, "I feel for 8 minutes on the screen, I should only get a little bit of him." That witty self-deprecation, combined with her immense authority, is her perfect professional signature.
And we should note that she didn't abandon the stage during this film explosion.
Not at all.
Yeah.
She maintained her theatrical roots by winning the Tony Award in 1999 for her Broadway performance in Sir David Hare's Amy's View. Within 3 years, she conquered British film, American film, and Broadway theater.
The new millennium, however, brought immense personal tragedy. Her husband, Michael Williams,
her co-star from A Fine Romance,
died of lung cancer in January 2001 after 30 years of marriage.
This is where that resilience thesis we mentioned really finds its application. She spoke about this time with surprising candor. She took on the filming of The Shipping News in Newfoundland almost immediately after the funeral.
She credited that relentless work as her rescue.
She did. She said, "Grief supplies you with an enormous amount of energy. I needed to use that up." The discipline of the craft became a vital emotional outlet for her.
So instead of retreating, she dove deeper into work, and that dedication continued to pay off.
It did. She earned her fourth Oscar nomination in just 5 years for portraying the novelist Iris Murdoch in Iris in 2001, sharing the role with Kate Winslet.
Her output during the 2000s is just a testament to her eclectic taste. She was providing lovely voice work as Miss Lily in the children's series Angelina Ballerina.
The sweet collaboration where her daughter, Fenty Williams, voiced Angelina.
But then you have this bizarre juxtaposition, high art followed by, well, utter sci-fi absurdity.
You're talking about Riddick.
She's playing Lady Bracknell in The Importance of Being Earnest in 2002, one of the most quotable roles in English literature. And then 2 years later, she appears in the sci-fi sequel The Chronicles of Riddick.
The Riddick role is essential to understanding her personality. Vin Diesel specifically wanted to work with her, and writers tailored the character for her.
And what did she say about it?
The anecdote she shared is classic Dench. She called it tremendous fun, but admitted she had absolutely no idea what was going on in the plot.
That is just incredible. She's a great actress, but she also seems to recognize that cinema is, at times, inherently ridiculous, and she can just embrace that fun.
And she immediately counterbalanced that with the acclaimed English drama Ladies in Lavender, starring alongside her friend and frequent collaborator Maggie Smith. She's constantly balancing the highbrow with the slightly bizarre and the deeply sentimental.
Then came the ultimate period role challenge, Lady Catherine de Bourgh in Joe Wright's hit adaptation of Pride and Prejudice.
And we have another wonderful casting anecdote here. Wright was desperate for her, knowing she embodied that necessary aristocratic severity. He persuaded her by writing a playful note saying, "I love it when you play a bitch. Please come and be a bitch for me."
And her willingness to embrace that role, the difficult character, provided the film with its necessary menace.
And she was only available for 1 week. The production had to prioritize her scenes, which is a huge testament to her star power. The film was a massive hit.
She finished the decade with a powerful, intense drama, earning her sixth Oscar nomination for Notes on a Scandal.
Opposite Cate Blanchett. She played Barbara Covett, a London teacher who becomes obsessed and manipulative, a truly dark, complex character. Dench stated that she was thrilled to be asked to play that woman, to try to find a humanity in that dreadful person.
And that statement just encapsulates her core objective, doesn't it? Injecting humanity into even the most morally deficient character.
It connects right back to the integrity developed during her Quaker-infused theatrical roots.
And we should also briefly mention her work anchoring the acclaimed BBC series Cranford in 2007. Again, balancing these intense global film roles with beloved, high-quality, character-driven British television.
It's that balance that defines her. Always.
As Dame Judi Dench entered her late 70s and 80s, her career trajectory, it didn't diminish at all. If anything, it intensified.
Right. She solidified her position as an undeniable box office draw, especially for films targeting specialty audiences, while simultaneously returning to the deepest parts of her theatrical identity.
The 2010s kicked off with this enormous, unexpected commercial success that confirmed her global bankability.
The best exotic Marigold Hotel in 2012 and its sequel in 2015.
These films starred a who's who of legendary British actors Dench, Maggie Smith, Bill Nighy, and they became these surprise international box office hits.
It proved that star power isn't exclusive to youth or action heroes. Critics called them sweet stories about the senior set and praised Dench as a resilient marvel. The success showed that the market would embrace sophisticated, character-driven comedy anchored by established talent.
And at the same time, she was conquering the global box office. She was returning to her true love, the stage, and breaking records.
Her theatrical returns were phenomenal. In 2010, she played Titania in A Midsummer Night's Dream, nearly 50 years after her first performance in that role. And in 2016, she won Best Supporting Actress for The Winter's Tale.
And that was her 8th Olivier Award win as a performer.
Breaking her own record. 8 competitive performance Oliviers. That record emphasizes maybe more than her Oscars, where her primary devotion and technical mastery reside.
And that dedication to challenging material continued in film, particularly in her partnership with director Stephen Frears.
Which led to her 7th Oscar nomination for the title role in Philomena in 2013.
What's so fascinating about the critical reaction to Philomena is how it highlighted a change in her persona. Time magazine captured it beautifully, writing, "This is Dench's triumph. At 78, she has a golden career behind her, often as queens and other frosty matriarchs. So the warmth under pressure she radiates here is nearly a surprise."
And that warmth, that vulnerability, was what made the performance so devastatingly effective. It showed her power to connect intimately with the audience through a quiet, searching character.
She reprised the Queen Victoria role a second time in Victoria and Abdul in 2017, earning her 12th Golden Globe nomination. And her collaboration with Kenneth Branagh, a director she first mentored in the 80s, continued.
She appeared in his Murder on the Orient Express, followed by a deeply personal project for Branagh, All Is True, where she played Anne Hathaway, Shakespeare's wife.
Oh.
And most recently, she received her 8th Academy Award nomination for Belfast,
making her one of the oldest nominees ever. That 8th nomination, spanning 5 Best Actress and 3 Best Supporting nods, is just a remarkable measure of her consistent power.
She truly is an anchor in whatever project she chooses. However, we have to acknowledge that not every choice is a triumph.
Oh, yes. Even the greats take the occasional misstep.
We are, of course, talking about the 2019 film adaptation of Cats.
The notorious Cats bomb. Universally panned, criticized heavily for the uncanny valley CGI, a box office failure. She starred as Old Deuteronomy.
And while it was a spectacular failure, it does show a strategic openness to risk, or perhaps a commitment to working with friends, even when the material is shaky.
What does that willingness to accept utter sci-fi absurdity and Riddick or feline CGI disaster in Cats say about her?
I think it suggests that the joy of the craft and the experience outweighs the fear of failure.
That focus on the joy of the experience seems critical, especially when we look at her personal resilience during this late stage of her career. She has found a wonderful new partnership.
Yes. Since 2010, she's been in a committed relationship with conservationist David Mills.
And the origin story is charming.
Oh, it's perfect. They met when she agreed to officiate at the opening of a new squirrel enclosure at the British Wildlife Center, where he's the founder. It sounds exactly like a plot point from a fine romance.
But underneath that charm and professional energy, she's been dealing with profound health struggles.
Most notably macular degeneration, which was diagnosed in 2012.
And this condition directly impacts her ability to work in the way she once did.
It does. It requires regular eye injections, and critically, it means she can no longer read scripts clearly herself. She relies on others, her daughter, friends, assistants, to read lines to her, which must require intense focus and memorization.
That shift in process is massive. For a stage actor whose life is defined by learning complex classical verse, losing the ability to visually read a script is a fundamental challenge.
And she has been incredibly candid about it. Reports from 2024 suggested her eyesight had deteriorated to the point where she couldn't go out alone. An interview in late 2025 detailed the severity, stating she couldn't recognize people, watch television, or read.
Yet despite these profound physical limitations, she has consistently maintained that she still wants to carry on working. That unwavering desire is the ultimate definition of her professional resilience.
And this defiance also fuels her public advocacy against ageism. She has spoken out strongly, saying, "I don't want to be told I'm too old to try something. Age is a number. It drives me absolutely spare when people say, Are you going to retire?
Beyond the screen and stage, her influence just permeates pop culture, sometimes in the most unexpected ways.
Absolutely, the full spectrum of British culture. She's a longtime supporter and honorary patron of Everton FC.
And then there's the viral moment,
where she featured in a video rapping with UK grime MC Lethal Bizzle, promoting his clothing brand, Stay Dench, using the slang term dench, which means excellent or cool.
From the Duchess of Malfi to a grime MC, she does it all. And she's also been unafraid to use her authority to enter cultural and ethical debates.
Most notably in 2022, when she publicly criticized the massive Netflix show The Crown.
She accused it of crude sensationalism and being cruelly unjust.
And crucially, she urged the show to add a fictional drama disclaimer. This highlights her insistence on theatrical integrity and factual honesty in public portrayals.
That criticism rings particularly true coming from someone who has successfully portrayed two queens with such nuanced realism. And finally, her advocacy extends to breaking real-world barriers.
Even in 2024, she continues to make history, becoming one of the first female members of the Garrick Club.
Which, for those unfamiliar, is a famously exclusive, historic London club, which had maintained a male-only membership for nearly 200 years.
To be breaking that specific historical barrier in her 90s just reinforces her status as a cultural giant who defies all limitations, both personal and societal. #outro. So to summarize the long, complex life of Dame Judi Dench, what we really see is a career built on astonishing versatility and constant artistic challenges.
She mastered classical Shakespearean tragedy and comedy, became the face of modern espionage as M, and achieved massive late-career film success as a leading lady in dramas like Mrs. Brown and Philomena.
And all of this was accomplished while maintaining this profound personal resilience in the face of immense grief and deteriorating health.
Her success, as we've seen, is underpinned by undeniable talent, quantified perfectly by those 8 total Academy Award nominations, 5 for Best Actress, 3 for Best Supporting Actress.
And that distribution confirms her power both as a central anchor and as an immediate, impactful force player. She is truly an acting force driven by integrity, not just celebrity.
Her stage work, her ability to make profound artistic statements in just minutes, and her continued history-making achievements like the Garrick Club membership all reinforce that status.
Her enduring success, and here is the provocative thought for you, the listener, to carry away, it raises an important question about our current media landscape.
What's that?
Given her immense success on stage, which demands constant rehearsal and complex memorization, and her ability to anchor major character-driven films, and considering her public criticism of highly fictionalized media like The Crown.
Okay.
What does Dench's unwavering focus on theatrical integrity and challenging material, even in her 90s, facing blindness reveal about the difference between acting excellence and celebrity longevity in modern media?
That's a great question. It suggests that when the foundation is built on excellence, on taking risks for the craft, and on finding humanity in every role, the stardom, no matter how late it arrives, will be enduring and undeniable.
She consistently chose substance over superficiality.
And that integrity is precisely what propelled her into becoming one of the most decorated and revered performers in history.
An excellent thought to end on, connecting the classical foundations to the demands of the modern era. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the extraordinary life and career of Dame Judi Dench.
We'll catch you next time.